Well, as Brother Pete mentioned in the announcements this morning, the thought of Israel and her restoration and her future experiences are on the mind of the brethren, and we hope as well, and the world as well, with her 60th anniversary, and even with the prospect of a new president being elected in the United States, the concern always is, well, how supportive of Israel will this country continue to be under new leadership? So that seems that question comes up every 4 years. So we thought that it would be a good time to take a look at the study 8 in volume 3, where Brother Russell talks specifically about the restoration of Israel, and to kind of update it, kind of put it in context of the present time and the events that have happened since that volume was written. That volume was written, I think it was completed sometime in the late 1890s. And Brother Russell was of the mindset, I'm sure when he wrote it, that most of these things would be accomplished in the next 20 years. Well, the next 20 years came and gone. The times of the Gentiles ended, but the church class was not complete and the kingdom was not established. We doubt if he thought that it would be another 30 years beyond that till the really founding of the nation of Israel as an entity recognized by the world would take place. And then beyond that, another 60 years would take place until the present day, and the fate of Israel would still be somewhat of a question as to how that would be accomplished. So we thought we'd take this opportunity. What I did is I kind of looked at the chapter as a whole, kind of divided it up into four different areas, and they're kind of represented in that bundle of questions, not just a single question, but I kind of formulated the question just as I kind of thought about each area and threw them out there. I probably did the one thing you shouldn't do as a leader of and ask a question you don't know the answer to. But I can tell you for sure that I don't know the answer to all these questions. And but hopefully with the four panelists here and myself, we can throw out some ideas and generate some discussion amongst the brethren, and maybe come up with some more, a little more insight into what's going to happen to Israel, how the past 100 years have fit into the context of the restoration of Israel. So that's where the subject came from. I've assigned one of these areas to each of the four elders here, but I very much hope that we can get some little interactive discussion here. I've promised them I would not ask a question kind of from left field that they've had no preparation for, but I may ask for a little elaboration depending on what each of the panelists say for these questions. The first question I've assigned to Brother Irwin, and I'll read it as you see it there on the outline. Brother Russell opens this chapter, that being the eighth chapter of the third volume, with an assertion that many peoples of the world historically have had a keen interest in the Jewish nation, and the people, and the land. Was that interest maintained through that time period between his death in 1948 and also even now to the present? And what indications would we point to in support of this, that the people have a general interest, the people of the world, that is, have a general interest in the restoration of Israel? And do you feel that, in general, what's the attitude of the world? Is it been supportive, or has it turned more anti-Semitic in the past decade or two? What direction are we going, kind of more in our time frame at the end of the age? So I'll turn it over to Brother Irwin for an opening comment. Again, I encourage all the panelists to contribute as well. Brother Irwin.
Brother Russ, feel free to cut me off.
Okay.
Because I have a little bit of everything here. I'd like to say that I'm glad that you mentioned when the volumes were written, because Brother Russell, in the fourth volume, I didn't mark the pages down, but he said that we expect greater things to happen in Israel, and they were not even a nation at that time,
right,
and we really didn't have much that you could speak of Israel. But it would be a strong feeling that I have that religious Christians have always been interested in the development of Israel and the prophecies. I know I didn't document all the things, but I know even the Moody Bible have shifted, because when they saw Israel in 1948, they realized that there'd be a great deal of prophecies that would have to be fulfilled. So I think that religious people are always watching Israel, because they're constantly in a newspaper. And I marked down two of the questions that they would always think about. And the first question would be, how much land will Israel get before the kingdom's set up? So that's a question that we know that they received four land title deeds. And the spread of land that they would have under that is much, much more than what they have at the present time. So that would be one question. And the second question would be the period of peace. Will Israel have a period of peace, and about how long it would last? And if we have time, the questions that you submitted, if we'd have time to talk about that proposed project of the canal, just a few minutes on that.
Sure.
I think that's significant. Okay. I'd like to mention that this has been a rich blessing to me, because I think it points to future prophecies that will come out in the future. Okay, so I copied from Wikipedia Encyclopedia, that's the free encyclopedia. It says the State of Israel joined the United Nations in May 11, 1949, and Israel has diplomatic relations with 162 states. The number is comparatively low, as a significant portion of the Muslim world does not recognize Israel. So Israel is a legitimate state, but there are high priorities in their foreign policy of Israel are seeking to end hostilities with the Arab world. So they had a Madrid conference in Spain in 1991, and Israel again established or renewed ties with 68 countries. But what's interesting is, as of 2008, 34 countries do not have any formal diplomatic relations with Israel. And actually, that's going to be all the Muslims. So this becomes important for future prophecies, that Israel will never be accepted like possibly other countries could be accepted. And Iran is a definite no with any relations with Israel. That gentleman, I don't know if I pronounce his name, that Ahmadinejad or whatever it is, he has proclaimed that the first thing that he'd like to do is destroy Israel. So this time, it's very fortunate that Europe, United States, and Israel are watching to see how this is going to develop. Because naturally, if he'd like to destroy Israel, he'll have a list of other countries that he'd like to destroy. And for those that knew or didn't know about this point, Syria is developing an atomic plant for atomic weapons. Not an atomic bomb. But very quietly, Israel informed certain parts of our intelligence, U.S., that they're going to take that plant out. And last year, very quietly and very effectively, that plant was bombed and it no longer exists. And Syria never said a word about it, because actually they don't want to advertise what that was all about. So that's very significant. So Europe is on the alert with the U.S. and the Jews to watch what's going on. Okay. But what I did find out that was very interesting, Brother Russ, is that Israel exports food to 90 countries in 2007, and the sale of foods totaled $436 million, and that's 20% more than 2006. And U.S. is first on the list, and possibly Russia is second. And the economy of Israel is growing with a lot of technical developments. So they have good relations with other countries now because of the exports. So it's not a question that, like, Europe is lukewarm to Israel, from what I could understand. They're not exactly going to raise their hands and cheer about Israel, or that they want to do anything against Israel. It's sort of a mixed thing there. And Israel is trying to improve their public relations. When Turkey had a disaster in 1999, Israel went to help. They're helping a lot of backward countries, too. They volunteer to help many backward countries. But the key thing that I learned from all of this is that no matter what Israel will do, there's a division. Countries will either accept Israel or the Muslims will not. So in the future prophecies, it's understandable that the Muslims are going to come against Israel. So that would be about it. Oh, and Germany does give a certain amount of money to Israel for every year for the damage that they did.
Reparations.
Yeah, like reparations for what they did against Israel. So that would be about what I have without going into a lot of, you know, detail about everything. But the Israel is improving technically, which is a very important point now, that may be the future spoils in the future.
Okay, thank you. Any other panelists like to comment on that first question? Art?
Are they in the news? Yeah, they seem to be quite a bit from a political standpoint as well as from a religious standpoint, beside the Muslims, as Brother Irwin mentioned. But I'm thinking of, like he did, the Moody's, the Adventists, the United Church of God. Even the Pope has a little bit of interest there because he visits the area. But some of the top people that they keep bringing up over from back to pastor's time to 1948 and even up to our time is they have some outstanding leaders. You know, they have Ben-Gurion. And there's a lot of historical information on him. Golda Meir and Wiseman and Moshe Dayan and even Albert Einstein. And so you have some of these top people bring the focus of the people all over the world to that country. And then since 1948, Israel, they had something like 19,000 Israeli soldiers that died. So that's usually something that alerts people. The Arabs have been trying to drive them into the sea, and that's periodically on the news. And that happened in 1948, 1956, 1967, 1973, with no results, except that they the wars start and it gets into the news. And then I noticed particularly the there were certain nations that are pressuring Israel to give up land. And Britain lost its empire because they were pushing. New Orleans in the Russian area, they were evacuated because of the problem. The Soviets lost their union. The Arab countries, armies, they had to resort to terrorism because they weren't getting anywhere. And so there's a lot of information that comes to the headlines to the people throughout the world that they keep abreast as to what's going on. It's just been a little while ago that a lot of the religious groups kind of turned their thoughts in the opposite direction where they didn't have much use for Israel. But now slowly they seem to recognize that the Lord is doing something there that they can't even explain. And so that's all I have to add.
Okay, thank you. Dan.
I think there's another thing that, along with what the brethren have said, is excellent. I think that there's an interest in the city of Jerusalem itself, and there are three major groups that have an interest in Jerusalem, and that's the Christianity, because of all of the holy churches and holiness of where Jesus walked. So Christianity is interested, the Jew is interested in it because of their own history and going back, and it was Jerusalem was the capital when David moved the capital to Jerusalem, and it became the two tribe kingdom all the way up until Nebuchadnezzar, and then when they returned from the captivity, it became the center again. And when they came back to the land, Jerusalem would have become their capital, except for the opposition that came from the Arabs, who also claim Jerusalem as their holy city also. So, and that's the only reason that Israel made a concession and that Jerusalem hasn't become their capital. They were going to make it their capital, and it was only because of the opposition and world pressure on them not to do that that they didn't. But when they in the 67 war, when they took over all of Jerusalem, it was thought at that point in time, again, to make that their capital. But again, it was pressure from the outside that they haven't. But scripturally speaking, Jerusalem will become the capital of the world from many, many scriptures in the Old Testament. And so, from that aspect, the city itself is very unique in that it has so much attention, international attention, brought to it just because of everybody who has an interest, vested interest in it. And one of the things that I thought was very interesting is the fact that they talk about the Palestinian. And the Palestinian problem and the poor Palestinians because they don't have a homeland. Well, if you go back into the history why it was being called Palestine, it goes back to the Roman Emperor Hadrian in the second century, 135 CE, as an insult to Israel and as a takeoff name of their ancient enemy, the Philistines, that he pronounced it
Palestine.
And the Jews were just as much Palestinians as the various Arabs who claimed to be the Palestinian of Palestinian descent. There is no nationality, the Palestinians. Yeah. And I think that's a very significant, point of clarification that we need to always remember, because the press does not recognize that.
Very good.
So I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, the PLO has a website, and they show a map of Israel with it's all Palestinian territory. There's no divided land. It's all Palestinian. And Brother Irwin brought out that, well, if we look at some of the scriptural indications is the amount of land Israel will ultimately gain, it's much bigger than the land they have right now. So kind of they're claiming in at least in this context, they're not personally as a nation, but we would see them as having a much broader expanse. So there's multiple claims on the entirety of the land, both by the Jews and the Palestinians. Now, we of course don't recognize the Palestinians, as Brother Dan said, they're not really a nation. They were nomadic. They're descendants of nomads that wandered the entire area, including Jordan and Syria and Egypt. And that's what that group of people really consist of. So they don't really have any long-term commitment on the land. Obviously, the Jews, we can date the descendants of Jacob back to that area of land. And, of course, Abraham was promised it. Being the patriarch of the Jewish nation itself. So there's real legitimate claim on the Jewish side, and there isn't on the Palestinian side. Erwin?
I'd just like to add that what Brother Dan is talking about is all covered. It's covered in Zechariah 12 chapter. That would be a special study by itself. But the Lord indicates that in the future, Jerusalem will be a troublesome city, and I think the key issue would be as to whether the world like to make it an international city, and then the Catholics want Jerusalem, the Muslims want Jerusalem, and the Jews want Jerusalem. So this might be the key issue that would bring on the great time of trouble.
Yeah. Actually, this push for internationalism is, if I can't have it, then nobody has it, because we're going to give it to everybody. That's
right,
really
right.
The...
Or we'll take it from you.
Right. That's really the paradigm. Aaron?
Well, I just want to make a comment on the domestic side. As we follow the presidential elections, obviously Obama's been in the news, and he's been supported worldwide by the Islamic nationalities and beliefs until the other day, because he had a peace talk or an accord, if you will, with some of the Israelis, and he said that Israel had the right to maintain and to negotiate for peace and to maintain their land. The Islamic people didn't like that. And then the Israel people really liked what they heard, because before this, he was more pro-Islamic. And when President Bush several months ago had made a comment about Israel, Obama jumped all over it trying to distinguish himself and separate himself from Bush. So the point is that Obama has said something that has pleased the nation of Israel, and then after the meeting, his advisor comes out and says, but that's subject to negotiation. And so he burnt the bridge he just built with the Israelis, and then because he took that stand for pro-Israel, now the Islamic nation has called for his assassination. So in domestic, you know, our presidential election is being watched more than any other election in the world because of what will the President of the United States do with this Middle East. So that's just something that just happened in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, there's I'm glad you brought that out. There's actually some interesting ties with at least Obama and the enemies of Israel. He sat on a small foundation called the Woods Foundation. There was just a small board of directors, and he was one of those boards of directors. And they've extended thousands of dollars in grant money to pro-Palestinian groups that openly promote anti-Israeli kind of viewpoints. So he's got a tie into the anti-Jewish mode than being a Jewish supporter. But again, that's not politically popular. So again, as Aaron mentioned, he has to kind of distance himself for that. So we'll just have to watch how that plays out. But he probably in the campaign will be viewed as more pro-Israel than anti-Israel, because that's where the votes are. Okay. Very good. We took probably a little more time than we should have on the first question, but, you know, these questions are not without interrelation. So there may be a little bit of overlap in some of the viewpoints of the brethren on these. Let's move to the second question, which we assigned to Brother Art. And, you know, Brother Russell has a subheading in there, which he titles, To the Jew First. And the natural question comes up, and Brother Russell doesn't spend a lot of time answering this, but the question that I have, and Brother Tom and I, we sometimes work together, we have discussions in the car together, and this is one of the questions we have: what really defines what a Jew is? In the Jewish view, I mean, you know, everybody will have a different perspective on this. What do the Jews say a Jew really is? What defines a Jew? What is God's viewpoint on what defines a Jew? Is a Jew of anyone of Jewish descent? And how is that descent measured? Is it anyone that is in heart sympathy with the Jews, including converts to Judaism that were not really born of a Jewish descent? And in that same paragraph organization where Brother Russell talks about To the Jew First, he spends an awful lot of time disputing this concept of Anglo-Israelites, what they are and why they don't have any inheritance really in the land, and what Anglo-Israelites are. So that's kind of the question. It kind of is broad in its concept, but we want to know, what's a Jew? When we just kind of say that a lot, the Jewish nation, the blesser nation, but who comprises that? Brother Art, who's a Jew?
Simple answer. He who belonged to the tribe of Judah. That's the definition you'll pick up. But it's a person belonging to the tribe of Judah, and in various places in Scripture, it brings out either the tribe of Judah or to Judah himself. And the first indication of it was found in 2 Kings 16:6 and 25:25. And it speaks of the Jew there after the time of the separation of the two tribes from the 10 tribes. And so the writer there was probably Jeremiah in Kings that he wrote of this. But it's the after that time why it's the definition became to everybody. Any Israelite returning from the different tribes would fall under the name of Jew. And then it was later on in Scripture you'll find that it refers to the Hebrews throughout the world to distinguish them from the Gentiles. And then also you could have the Gentiles that...
Yeah, wait, let me just question you on that. Okay. So Hebrews at that time would be descendants of any of the tribes of Jacob?
Well,
When you say Hebrew is distinguishing from Gentiles.
Correct.
That's what we're talking about. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. And then the others were the Gentiles when they were proselyted. Then they were referred to also as Jews. And then later on it became Israel that the name got worked into the identification of the Jew. So from the Jewish view, why, that's the progression that it took. But it all depends on who you speak to today as to what a Jew is. But according to the Lord, the Jew is he who is, we'd refer to, and I think the pastor does also, in volume 3, where he mentions an Orthodox Jew, one who understands the law, lives by the law, and at the same time prays on a daily basis, and he takes these Jewish rituals and so on seriously. And so he would be the Jew, and that's the one that the pastor seems to refer to, while the rest of the Jews, which I think one of the brethren have as the Reformed and some of the other Jews, are those that are offshoots from them. And so that's just the basic beginning of that. But in volume 1, page 297, he lets you know that it's the Jew first, the pastor does, and he mentions the various scriptures that, you know, particularly the one we're all familiar with in Isaiah 2, 2 and 3, chapter 2, verse 2 and 3, as well as in Jeremiah, and then there's a few in Isaiah. And so from a third angle, why then the figurative definition of a Jew is the Israelite indeed. Where that's where the Israel, but you're not, your question doesn't deal with that.
Right.
So you got the Orthodox, unorthodox, the Reformed, the conservative, you got nominal, and so you have quite a few. But getting into the other portion of our lesson, what about the Anglo-Israelites? And briefly stated, he claims, the pastor mentions, that the Anglo-Saxons, the people which are of the United States, and they refer to themselves as the descendants of Israel, which separated from the tribe of Judah and Benjamin after Solomon's death. And it's, they're the ones that are referred to as the 10 lost tribes. And so they feel that they fall under the 10 tribes that were dispersed all over. And slowly some of them came back, but you couldn't recognize them. And this is where they feel, the Anglo-Israelites or the Anglo-Saxons, that it refers to America and primarily Britain. And back at the time the pastor wrote this, why, if you remember, England was one of the superpowers at that time. They roamed the nine seas or seven seas with their fleet. And the sun never set on the British Empire and so on and so forth. So back then they had that initial security. They felt that this must be it. But when you come down to our day, you don't see much of what was British occupied lands and the power that they had. And to bring you up to date, so the pastor in the volume, and particularly they were quite active in his day, so he refutes that, and he spends time on it because that was kind of a going thing. But if you punch into the computer, you'll find that at this day, they're kind of, you could say, they're in Arizona, their headquarters are, in the desert, and it seems like since the pastor's time to our time, there have been various different leaders. And through these leaders, there's such variation of thinking on many of the doctrines and so on. And right now, they come under the name of Yahweh's New Kingdom. And that was a particular leader that they had in 1988. And then in 1992, they got another publication they call the Kingdom's Voice. But there's such a variation, like I said, in some of their teachings. And I wasn't able to plug into how many members they have presently. But it seems that some of their teachings are now supplemented with New Age health tips, secrets about Yahweh's spaceships, secrets about the lost civilizations, And they have various publications, and that has come about by the different leaders they've had over the years. And so their theme still is, and they put it out in their publications, that get off the coasts seems to be one of their highlights, that this comes from Yahweh. Get off the coast. And it's talking about California. It's talking about Florida. It's talking about New York, because that's where the catastrophes will come. And so just by looking into a little bit of this, you see that it's not in everyday religious groups that they're mentioned. It's kind of remote, and that's because they've had different leaders, and they're kind of dwindled down somewhat.
So they're a non-factor at this time compared to Brother Russell's day.
Back at this time, it was a growing thing. Today, it's a decreasing thing since the pastor's time. Or a little later, it seems to be less and less.
Okay, thank you. Any more thoughts on what's a Jew? What's a Jew in the context of, you know, the chart? We have a nice block in the millennial age that we label Israel restored. Who's in that block? Erwin?
Brother Russ, this will be just a little different view on... I'll just concentrate on what you said first, to the Jew first. Okay.
Okay.
I'm impressed with the fact that the word special treasure in the New American Standard is in the margin. So it uses the word special treasure three times. In Exodus 19, 5 and 6, there's a promise to Israel that I will make of you a kingdom of priests and so forth. So that would be to the Jew first. But it ended up that they evidently didn't have much regard in that promise. So it would be a remnant which becomes spiritual Israel. So now spiritual Israel becomes first, because the next time special treasure is used is in Malachi 3, 16 and 17. God said he will gather his jewel, that spiritual Israel, special treasure. So God will have special treasure. And then in Deuteronomy 7, chapter 7, verse 6, it mentions that natural Israel will be special treasure to God. So the Jews are always going to be first, because God never really cast them off forever. So that's why on our chart, you'll see Israel on a human plane is a little higher, because they're supposed to be that blesser nation for the whole world of mankind. So I do like the thought of special treasure is used three times, two for spiritual and one for earthly.
Okay, thank you.
And it doesn't have anything to do with the origin of the Jew.
Jew, okay. Dan? Nobody's answered my question yet.
I think one of the things that in this kind of goes into the perspective of my question, and that is Orthodox, you know, the different types of Jewish religious affiliation is Orthodox, Conservative, Reformed, and Nominal. I think what the brethren have been saying, if you go back to the Old Testament, those that believed in the law and those that accepted the law, these are the ones that were called, that were under special relationship with the Lord, because they came under special relationship at Mount Sinai with the law covenant. And they had the first opportunity at Jesus' day to become spiritual Israelites. And the nation as a whole rejected, but there was a nucleus of Orthodox ones that did live under the law that accepted Jesus as the Messiah and became Christians. And in fact, it was such a strong desire to be under the law that, you know, some of them wanted to continue that, even though under Jesus's arrangement, it's particularly once the in AD 36 when the bulk of the nation had rejected, and the call was opened up to the Gentile as well as to the Jew, that in the Jerusalem conference took place in Acts 15, because they wanted the Gentiles, this faction wanted the Gentiles to come under the law arrangement as well as being Christian. And you know, and as we recognize, you know, today that this is not the case. The law covenant was nailed to the cross by Jesus, and Paul brings this out very, very specifically. So, you know, but going back to if you don't accept Jesus, then you're still under the law covenant arrangement. And I think that these are the ones that the Lord, you know, when we look on the chart and we see the Jewish, when it says, you know, the church, the great company, the nation of Israel, I think it's the ones that will accept the Lord's arrangement at Jacob's trouble. And just to, as a side note on that particular point, I found there was a discourse a brother gave a number of years ago, and I appreciated it, and I'll share it with you. I've shared it with many. The possibility of Jacob's trouble, you know, the Gog and Magog invasion taking place at the time of Passover. And at Passover, the religious Jew is going to stay home and celebrate the Passover. The non-religious Jew is going to go out and fight the battle. The non-religious Jew is going to fail. But one of the things that the religious, at the Seder, at the Jewish Seder, they put forth Elijah's cup. And I, you know, and the thought was expressed that this would be the time when the ancient worthies would be resurrected and come in and take the cup and explain the plan of God, you know, to those. And there will be a conversion at that point in time, and that this is the ones that will be in Zechariah, the 14th chapter, that will go forth, and the Lord will go forth and fight for them as he fought for them in the days of old, and that there will be a recognition that Jesus is the Messiah, because the ancient worthies will tell them, and they will be perfect. They will be resurrected perfect, and so they will have the ability to convince the religious Jew, and they will be the ones who will the kingdom will go forth from that point. So that, in answer to your question, I think that that's the answer.
Okay.
That appeals to me anyway.
Let me try and summarize it so I know, and I'm not questioning it. I'm just trying to understand it. So what you're saying is Jews, as far as God is concerned, as far as who we will consider as part of the blesser nation in the kingdom arrangement, are those who have placed themselves under the law or at the time during the and or during the time of trouble, did not necessarily participate as members of the Jewish government and Jewish military, but those who still maintain their allegiance to God. We would tend to call these mostly Orthodox,
right?
Maybe some conservative. I mean, you know, yeah. in order kind of in those who maintain the closeness to the dedication to the Jewish law. In order of, you know, most to least, would be in the order which we listed them there: Orthodox, Conservative, Reformed, and Nominal. Those who just consider themselves residents of Israel and don't have much regard for the Scriptures at all. But those are, the most conservative, the most dedicated to the law would be the Orthodox.
Right.
They maintain the address. Okay, thank you. Anyone else on this question of what's a Jew? Especially as far as God's concerned, because we tend to like just put that label up there on the chart, and I'll throw this question out there. If no one has a comment on it, that's fine. And this came from, again, my discussions with Brother Tom. It seems odd that we want to say that those who are considered Jews by God are those who maintain their loyalty to the law. And yet we say that God's Son nailed that law to the cross, and following it is no longer important to God, especially as far as those who want to be true to God in the fullest context. But for the sake of that defining who is part of the Jews in the kingdom arrangement, we're going to say it's those who continue to follow the law. Dan?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things is that, you know, the nation as a whole was cast off from favor in the AD 33 when Jesus wept over the city, mm-hmm. and cast them off. But their time of disfavor is 1845 years, and that ended in 1878. And so from 1878 onward, it's again, he's bringing his favor back to them, but he's bringing it back to them as a nation. And how did he deal with them as a nation? He dealt with them under the law covenant arrangement. And It isn't until they can't get the new covenant arrangement until they accept Jesus as the Messiah. Then they start to become part of the new covenant arrangement. And I think it's at that point in time, and that's Jacob's trouble when that happens. And it's at that point onward that they really are part of what we would consider on the chart as the Jew first.
Okay. So what you're saying, and again, I'm trying to interpret it, what you were saying. So what you're saying is, even though we say that Jesus nailed the law to the cross, fulfilled it entirely, the law doesn't disappear because of that. It remains a standard by which Jews can define themselves. Okay. Thank you.
Anyone else? They did all down through the age.
Okay. Anyone else here?
Just real quickly, you know, Paul in the book of Romans talks about the Jews, and he's referring to the Israelites. The Lord Jesus, when he talked about the Israelites, was referring to the Jews. They didn't make a distinction between the two. During the time the pastor wrote this
chapter,
yes, thank you. He had a conversation he had a written response back to a magazine who challenged some of the things that he was saying, and he recorded in this chapter. And what he was making the point was, at that time, in the late 1800s, they were saying the Jews are only from the tribes of Benjamin and Judah, and the other 10 tribes are these Anglo-Israelites. And he was trying to make the point was that, no, they're one and the same. It doesn't matter if you're from the 2 tribes or from the 10 tribes. God is dealing with you as the nation of Israel, as an Israelite or a Jew. Now, the promise to Abraham that was given was, in thee and thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And because of Abraham's faithfulness, his seed becomes a blesser nation. We see the two aspects of it, the world and the spiritual. But then that same seed was narrowed down through Jacob to the nation of Israel. So today, Israel themselves are trying to define who is a Jew, because it affects them personally, because who they let in as a citizen determines whether or not how they define the word Jew. So Israel's law of return says that anyone who is Jewish can automatically be a citizen. Well, what does that mean? What it means is that if you have a Jewish spouse, a Jewish parent, or a Jewish grandparent, you are automatically granted citizenship if you apply, unless you have converted to another religion. So right now, this is as of Monday, December 24th, 2007. This is from the BBC News regarding Jewish return. And there's a statement in this article that says, more than 1 million Muslim and Christian Arabs also have Israeli nationality, but they are not citizens of Israel because they don't qualify under the fact that they didn't keep...
They did convert.
So when we talk about a Jew now, it's much more than just those who claim to be... who claim to keep the law. It really traces back to the promise to Jacob. And God's going to keep that promise. But he's going to deal, as Brother Dan already mentioned, he's going to start with those who are closest to him first. And as the others witness and see the activities and the blessings that those who follow his law receive, they're going to start raising and identifying with their nationality as well. So I see it starting with the true Jew, you know, of spiritual, but it being extended to all the Jews because of those two promises to Abraham and then narrowed down through Jacob.
Interesting. So then, according to the Jewish law, those Gentiles, for lack of a better term, who have converted to Judaism, the religion, are not necessarily Jews because they don't qualify as having the descendant part as well. Do I read that right?
You know, I can't answer that.
Okay.
I couldn't answer that.
There are several prominent, quote, Gentiles.
Yeah.
I think it's Dr. Laura on radio. She's a Christian. She was a Catholic by birth, but she married a Jewish individual and has converted to Judaism.
Right.
So she considers herself a Jew.
Yeah, if you have a Jewish spouse.
Oh, a Jewish spouse. Okay, right. that would qualify.
Right, but I don't know about a proselytized.
Yeah.
And I think it is, but I can't prove it with what I have right in front of me.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. But again, that's the Jewish government perspective for the purpose of citizenship. It's not just defining what our terms are. It's also defining the perspective of the group making the definition. And in this case, we're most interested in God's definition. And I think I think Brother Dan really got to the crux of the issue. Is there has to be some kind of standard by which God will recognize who is a Jew. And those living close to his arrangement, which in the Jewish age was the law and continues for those who don't consider themselves out from under the law, i.e. the Christians or Gentiles in general. Okay, we've only got a few minutes left, and we kind of touched a little bit on Dan's question. That's number three. But you have something to add, I'll give you the
floor. Well, I'm just going to mention the fact of what Brother Russell talks about in the third volume as one of the perspectives that he saw, what he expected to take a much greater influence hasn't. Okay, and that was the Rabinowitz movement. Mm-hmm. Back in his day, back when he wrote the volume in 1890, the Rabinowitz movement was very prominent. Today, it's way down the scale as far as prominence goes. And so, Brother Russell, saw that, and Rabinowitz recognized Jesus as the Messiah, and that was one of the key issues. And that really never took off. There are those in Israel that do recognize. They call them Masonic Jews. They do recognize it, and the whole point of Jews for Jesus in this country and that is all pointing at the fact of converting the Jew to Christianity, because it's the Christianity that's being taught, and that's the doctrine of the Trinity is one of the biggest stumbling blocks to it. And but Jews for Jesus and whatnot, all of those accept the Trinitarian view of, and this is one of the things that makes Brother Kenneth Rawson's presentations very acceptable in Israel, because he does not teach the Trinity.
Right.
And being a Bible student, he definitely doesn't point to Jesus as being a part of a triune God. But I think that what Brother Russell expected didn't have a fulfillment, because Brother Russell was looking at, when he wrote the volume again, he was aiming at 1914 as the completion of everything, and when 1914 came. I find it interesting, even in 1911, he began to caution the brethren, don't put so much emphasis on 1914, because there are a whole lot of prophecies and events and things that need to happen that haven't happened. And I think that, these are one of the things that we look to today, and we still feel the door is open, and we still feel the prophecies are continuing, and the Gog and Magog invasion is still yet future.
Yeah. I think you bring out a good point, Dan, in that probably the major obstacles to Jews now seeing, lending any credibility to Jesus at all, is the Trinity. And if In the kingdom work, when God makes that clear to them that Jesus is the Messiah and he is not a part of God, but is in fact a separate being, I think those two things will come together and be very, they'll have to be convinced of it, because we believe it's the truth. Okay, we're down to 9 minutes, and we're down to question number four. I'll give the floor to Aaron. The progress of the Jewish restoration. So we've been talking about the Jews, the restoration of Israel is our overall subject. But is it complete? Have all the Jews that are ever going to go back to Israel, and not down to the last nth, but in terms of general population, is that work complete? Is it still going on? Does the world consider it complete? Do we consider it complete? Does there have to be a lot more immigration to Israel of Jews from all over the world, not just this nation, to fulfill that, to fulfill the promise of that? And how should we view the evangelical perspective. You know, it's kind of almost... It's not really kind. They see they're looking toward the rapture, Armageddon, all those events taking place, and they view Israel as one of the prime motivators, causers of that. The conflict in Israel is being a motivation toward that happening. So they're looking for the return of the Jews, not really for a good thing into what it brings to the Jewish people, but the fact that it brings out Armageddon and their deliverance. So it's kind of a two-sided kind of thing where they're encouraging that. So what's our perspective on that? And what do we think the next step that we should look for in the return of the Jews? So, Aaron, it's kind of a broad question.
Yes, there's more than one.
I'm looking to you to narrow it down and give us.
Well, there's a lot of questions here. There's actually four specific ones, and I did a lot of research online. I went to some of the Israeli and Jewish websites to find this information. So according to the same article I just referred from BBC News, as of December 2007, their headline is Jewish Return Hits 20-Year Low. So they're saying right now that they have fewer than 20,000 Jews arriving in 2007, and that's been a decline over the last 20 years. But the nationality of Jews has been increasing and growing just because, you know, they're spread throughout all the world. And when we talk about the return of the Jews, I also went to a website, the Jewish Agency for Israel, and they have some demographics. So let me just share a couple of those with you. They say as of 2002, the country of Israel has a population of 6,509,000. Azerbaijan has a population of Jewish people. These are Jewish people. 8,041,000. So just in that one country alone, there's in the Europe, there's more than that, what's currently there in Israel. Let's see what the United States has. Okay, United States has 5,700,000 Jews in just the United States alone. And then some.
There's only six in Israel, right?
There's only six in Israel, yeah. And then the Jewish, one more demographic here. The city of Tel Aviv in Israel has a population of 2,575,000. New York alone has 2,051,000. So the largest city in Israel, New York, has almost that many Jews just in the city of New York alone. So we can see that there are a lot more Jews not in Israel than there are obviously in Israel. Well, then that begs the question, well, how do you know when everybody's going to return has returned? And if you think that there has to be a certain number, I don't think it's the right thought. You know, Israel's landlocked. They only have so much land. And so the challenge they face is how do they keep allowing Jewish citizens to return and give them this citizenship and yet give them a job and give them a place to stay and not drain their national economy. So the way they do it is by being smarter and making more concessions amongst their own people. So their own people realize that their standard of living goes down a little bit every time they bring someone in, but collectively they're willing to do that. So I personally don't think the exodus back to Israel is complete. I don't think the world typically speaking, thinks so. However, if you're Islamic, I think they expect that it's done, and they're going to reverse that trend because they want to destroy Israel. So that's how I'd answer question one. Does the world consider it complete? Yes and no. What is our position on the magnitude of future Jewish return to the land? I think it's going to keep growing, and I think the issue is for Israel is going to be is how do we accommodate the influx? And we can see that it's been declining, and some of the articles said, well, it really makes a lot of sense because before in the last 20 years, the conditions around the neighboring countries that drove the Jews to Israel have diminished. So it's been less persecution in France. It's been less persecution in Israel or in Russia and in Europe. So they feel more comfortable there, so they're not being driven as much. But if situations change, then they're going to drive them out again, and they'll flee back to Israel or flee to Israel for the first time. How should we view the evangelical perspective on encouraging more Jews returning? Well, that was really an interesting question because about 20 years ago, Israel started bringing over evangelical Christians from America. Well, even more than 20 years ago. It's been about 40 years now. And what they wanted to do was to introduce Israel to the United States and to the Christianity that's here. So they figured the best way they could do it is by getting to the religious leaders. So they brought them over, gave them free trips, showed them, you know, the country, showed them the benefits of bringing groups over. And what they were doing was trying to win the hearts of America for Israel. And they've been quite successful. So now what's happened is that many of these conservative Christian groups are actually pushing, not in our congregation necessarily, but the thinking that Israel is a dominant player in the Middle East and that we have to stand for Israel and Israel has to take a stand. Because the more aggressive Israel is in the stands with their neighbors, the faster we're going to bring Armageddon on. So their perspective is we're going to help God's plan by supporting Israel and strengthening Israel so they can stand so Armageddon's brought in sooner and faster. So that seems to be the evangelical perspective. What is the next major step we should expect to observe in the events surrounding the Jews? That's really a wide open question. One of the things when I was
all the panelists there, by the way.
Okay. One of the things I found was that, you know, we talk about the Palestinians and their claim to being able to come back to the land of Israel, or the land that Israel now occupies, and that that's their right to the land. But what you don't hear in the conversation is that there are many Israelites in the Arab nations, or there were, and many of them have been kicked out. So now they have a claim to that land in Arab countries. If Arab countries are claiming the right to claim land in Israel, now the Israelites are starting to claim land back in the nations that kicked them out. So this is March 26, 2008. This is in the American Thinker. It's called The Right of Return and the Forgotten Refugees. And I'm going to just read a quote here. According to official Arab statistics, 856,000 Jews leaving their homes in Arab countries from 1948 until the early 1970s. The property they were forced to leave behind is worth more than $300 billion today. The expelled Jews held deeds to 100,000 square kilometers, more than four times the size of the state of Israel. Before the United Nations became an agent of animus towards Israel, it recognized the plight of all refugees. The U.S. General Assembly Resolution 194, which was passed on December 11, 1950, recommended that both Palestinian and Jewish refugees should be permitted to return if they are willing to live in peace with their neighbors. So right now, the Israelites are starting to claim, all right, you kicked me out of my home, and I owned that property. I still own that property. You owe me that property. So they're seeing a reversal here. So I think this is going to be something that becomes more and more on the table of negotiations. The fact that, okay, if you want me to return something that you claim I took from you, then you return what you took from me. I think that's going to become a larger factor.
That's very interesting. Thank you, Brother Aaron.
Sure. One more thing, and that is that we have the, you know, you hear President Bush talk about the roadmap to peace. And that was supposed to be finalized in 2003. Well, most Christians believe that if you follow that roadmap to peace, it's not going to work. So what we're going to see coming up, and I think in this election is going to be a big indicator of it, is what is our country's stance with the nation of Israel. And Israel knows that we are her big supporter, and if we walk away from Israel, they are left stranded. And what was really interesting, I found that right now they are making negotiations, Israel, with Syria outside of United States' blessing, and the United States is not too happy with them. Because if Syria is one of these access of evil nations, then she's our enemy, and if it's an enemy of the United States, it better be an enemy of Israel. And Israel is saying, well, I'm an autonomous nation. It's in my right, in my purview to make a treaty with Syria independent of the United States. So right now there's a little bit of friction between our two countries. And that's something that's going to play up to them. So I'll let others speak.
Okay. Thank you. Erwin, go ahead.
No.
Oh, okay. I thought you were looking at me. Anyone else have a comment on this before we close? Speak now or forever hold your peace.
Well, I think, I'll speak. I think, one of the things that we don't know what will bring on the Gog and Magog invasion. One of the things that I'm looking at, at least I'm favoring it at this point in time, is we used to always, when communism was in full swing, that the nations from the north were communistic countries coming down to take a spoil. As to what the spoil was always an open question. I'm beginning to look more and more towards the, if you look at what is due north of Israel, it's all Muslim. All of southern Russia is all Muslim. In fact, Azerbaijan that Aaron was talking about is almost all Muslim. All of these areas north of Israel is Muslim, and I think possibly, and I mentioned this earlier, that just in passing, in that the city of Jerusalem might be the prize itself, because if you look at who wants Jerusalem, it is the three groups: the Christianity, the Jew, and the Muslims. At this point in time, Christianity or churchianity is no more. Jezebel is gone, and so that leaves two left: the Jew and the Muslims. And I think the Muslims have always wanted Jerusalem. That's one of the big pushes of push Israel into the sea and to destroy them in the nation, so that they can take hold of all of the Jerusalem is the third most. I think it's the third. I think there's Mecca.
It's Medina. The first. Yeah, the first one is Mecca. Medina is second.
Yeah, Medina is second, and Jerusalem is third. Okay, and so looking at it from that aspect, we can see. I can see that the Gog and Magog invasion will be the Arab nations coming to take a spoil, and that's the city itself.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else before we summarize? Thank you, brother. I appreciate all your comments. I found one other interesting quote in doing some research on my own. The pastor that is quoted as being anti-Catholic that was trying to be tied to John McCain is a guy by the name of Hagee. And he's actually founded an organization called Christians United for Israel. He founded that in the late 2005. And I thought one of the comments he made in talking and trying to justify that he wasn't really anti-Catholic, but his remarks about her being the whore of Revelation and that kind of things. He talked about his support of the Jews as is not characteristic of someone who would be put as kind of this hate monger that they were trying to cast him at. And his response to that was, during the Holocaust, this is a quote, during the Holocaust, too many Christians were silent, and we were left to mourn the slaughter of 6 million Jews. Today, Bible-believing Christians must speak up and stand for Israel. We must act to do whatever we can to protect Israel's 6 million Jews from a second Holocaust. We must get it right this time. Our faith demands it. The time requires it. Silence is not an option. And in that context, he quotes Isaiah 62:1, which says, "For Zion's sake, I will not keep silent. And for Jerusalem's sake, I will not keep silent. And until her righteousness goes forth like a brightness and her salvation like a torch that is burning." And I think that kind of summarizes our position in support of Israel as well. That we view the nation of Israel as being a barometer of the progress of the establishment of the kingdom, and again, that promise of being a blesser nation was contained really in the Abrahamic promise, and it was not a conditional one; it's unconditional. And the position of Israel in the kingdom arrangement is assured from times of old, and we hope this presentation to some of the panelists' discussion has been a blessing to you, and I'm sure it'll generate some questions to some or all of us.